And now it really does give me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening. It's Sarah from the San Marino Group.
All right.
Oh, we did, yes. And it, yeah. And I was staring at the pattern and it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Little enhancements. They're alcoholic.
Sarah.
And I was trying to cut them up for every reason. Not like, I don't get this. I enjoy going to speaker meetings. I enjoy listening to other people. I enjoy relating to every, you know, to all the speakers I can get something out of. But I hate doing it. It's like, oh. But I know everybody, so it's, you know, it's like, yeah. My sobriety date is January 30th of 06. I have a sponsor, Francine, and she has a sponsor, Julie, and Julie's sponsor is in Rio Grande. I am a, you know, I, my childhood was wonderful. Growing up, I had awesome parents. I will put this out there. I was an adopted child. Still working on the genetic side and the, you know, the biological things. I've gotten some information on that, and it's quite disconcerting to me. But as far as I'm concerned, my mom and my dad, I mean, they were given a broken child, and that was wired different from the start. I was a colicky baby. I didn't want to be held. I pushed away. Didn't like sleeping. I was allergic to the formulas. I was allergic to everything. And they kept me. You know, they did the best they could with what they were given. I have an older brother. He's 2 years older than me. He's a normie. I come from a family of normies. I know that alcoholism, I have a cousin who's an alcoholic in recovery. I have another cousin who we believe is still in recovery. And I have an uncle that, yeah, he was one of us. There's just no doubt in it. I was born in Michigan, and we moved to Florida, and the first 10 years of my life were in Florida. You know, a kid's dream. We lived a block away, block and a half away from the ocean, and a block and a half away from the Indian River. We had lemon and grapefruit orchards behind us and a church, and then there was a section of palmetto, what we call palmettos. It was a swampy area. There was big bugs. There was gators. There was frogs. You could, in the Indian River, the inlet was just a quarter mile down, so it was nothing to pull, see dolphins in the river, or pull small sharks out of there when we were fishing off the pier. It was a perfect existence. As far as kids growing up, I gave my mother, she probably got gray hair to begin with, for me, early on. You know, she would dress me up, she would make these beautiful outfits. And I can remember one in particular. It was Easter, and it was a white eyelet pinafore over a yellow dress underneath, so you could see that, and she had put the yellow, she had some of the yellow material around the socks, and I had white patent leather shoes, and I had pigtails with big bows in them, and it was raining kind of outside. We were in Florida, so it was, you know, rain off and on, and I knew that there was pollywogs and frogs out back, so me and my beautiful white eyelet Easter Sunday outfit, I went out pollywog hunting. Needless to say, I ended up getting put in the bathroom and getting hosed off. And I went to church, and my wet, white eyelet, muddy-ish, but But I got polywogged, so it was all good. I didn't have a lot. There weren't too many gals, little girls around where we were raised. There was a lot of boys. My brother had a lot of friends, and I would run with the boys. They played with the Green Army men. We had a big sandbox. We'd, you know, dig the trenches, and you dug this far down and you got water. The water table was so high. And so we'd play Army out there, and my poor Barbies got blown up every time we turned around. I had the Briar horses, the horse statues that I loved. And I would break the Barbie's legs to sit on those. You know, I just wasn't the girly girl. I absolutely wasn't. My mom kept trying. She'd put the foo-foo stuff on and I'd be out there. I mean, in grade school, she sewed beautifully. She made some wonderful outfits. And she finally figured out that she had to make pantaloons in the same material as the dresses because I wasn't dainty. And, you know, she did the best she could. Animals were part of my life there. The neighbors had two dogs across the street and a cat, and we ended up with an old white tomcat found us. And yes, Peter, cats. Decided that we were going to be his new family, and he was all beat up, and so Mom took him to the vet and got him fixed up, and Snowflake was my buddy. I mean, he went everywhere with me. I go tromping out in the palmetto swamps, and it was funny because one of the neighbor's dogs would be with me and the white cat. And I just take off and go out and play. And I'm grateful for those animals because they were my friends. They would listen to me. I could talk to them. And they never judged me. They never judged anything about me. I was diagnosed in Florida, which was like state-of-the-art place, with learning disabilities. And because I was always the kid in the class, when the teacher went around and said, "Oh, stop being stupid. You can write better than that. Stop being lazy. That's dumb." And those things were etched in my head. Those are the voices that I had in my head. So when I went around with the animals, they weren't there. You know, they were non-judgmental, just loving critters. When my dad worked at Cape Canaveral, and after they put a man on the moon, and then it was decided that the whole space industry bottomed out. So my dad got laid off, and he was devastated. It was scary, because here he had a wife and two kids, and no income, and now what? You know, there's no openings anywhere around there, and the choices of jobs were either in Texas or California. So he and Mom came out here. They went to Texas, and then he interviewed there, and then he brought Mom out to California, and they interviewed, and they decided that California is the place we're going to go. So they come back and they tell me that, you know, well, we're going to move to California. And I was like, no, you know, I have horseback riding lessons. I got the neighbor's dogs. I've got Snowflake. I got a guinea pig that, you know, no, we can't leave. This is my safe place. You know, where else am I going to go out and have a secret little fort out in the palmettos where I'm safe? And Mom said, okay, well, we're going to have to find homes for the cat and the guinea pig and everything. We're moving. And I packed up my guinea pig and my cat and the neighbor's dog, because Duchess went everywhere with me. And I went out in the palmettos, I was it. I ran away. 10 years old, I ran away from home. I didn't want it. That's nope. Me and the critters for the rest of my life. I'm not going to ever talk to another human being, ever. Dad came out and found me. He knew where I was. He knew where my cool fort was. He came out and found me, and he told me that we'd never leave anything that we love behind. So he built a cage for my guinea pig that fit perfectly between the front seat and the back seat on the hump in the car. So when we moved, we had a guinea pig squeaking. We had a cat that absolutely did not want to be in the car. So he was underneath the front seat howling. And we came out to California. We came out here. There was they didn't have any idea what dyslexia was. They had no idea about any learning disabilities. When we left Florida, the math level, it was, we had just gotten to multiplication. And we were at that level there. So when we got out here, they're on long division. And I'm looking at all these numbers and they're jumping all over the place and nothing is making sense. I know nobody in the schoolroom. I've only got my guinea pig and my cat. Although the rental that we rented in on the other side of the wall, there was a whole bunch of cattle, so I made friends with the cattle. And school started to become hell, absolute hell. I went from one school to another, started at May Grisham, and then over to Pine Grove, Joe Nightingale, and then over to Pine Grove, and then I ended up at May Grisham, because where we moved, that was when the house was finished. That's where we were at. And each place, it was like I was the odd one out. I talked funny. Growing up around military, I had Georgia, I had Carolinas. People asked me where I was from, and I'd say, well, I'm from Florida. And they'd made fun of me because I definitely talked funny. I was the tallest kid in the class. Grade school was hell. And one of the things that Dad told me was, because I was so upset about, the writing lessons and this wonderful riding stable that I was a part of, and that I showed horses with and stuff. And he said, well, out in California, we'll be able to get you a horse. And I had been saving my money for a long time. I had been picking weeds in Florida. I had been saving dimes, nickels, quarters, dollars, ironing handkerchiefs. That's what you did. The neighbor lady would pay me to iron her husband's handkerchiefs and pillowcases. But I had saved up some money. And for a 10-year-old kid to have $310 in a bank account, that was a lot of money. That was a whole bunch of money. So we started looking for a horse. And back then, you could get a horse for $150. Okay, so we're talking 1970. Damn, I'm old. And looking for the right horse. It's got to be the right size, the age, and everything else. And I kept on saying, no, 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 you know. And my parents were bound and determined that this one horse, her name was Trixie. She was POA, she was decent, broke, you know, right at the level where I was at. I was like, no, no, that's not the one. No. And then we met up with the guy that ran the stables there at Ann Foxmoor's, where we had our house. And Paul Mullen said, let me introduce you to another cowboy. He's got some horses. So, and listening to Benny Young, he says, I got a horse for you. And he says, you go over there and you talk to that horse in the pen and see what you think about her. And I went over, and I went to pin, and I started just rubbing on her, and I'm like, this is her. This is the one. This is my horse. And he told me, he says, well, she's more than what you can afford, and she's more than you can ride, but I'll work with you. And that was probably the first adult, other than my parents, mainly my father, that I trusted. And Paul Mullen was right there too. You know, I trusted those guys. They taught me a lot of stuff. You know, I got this horse that I was way over my head on, and I learned stuff the hard way. You know, you check your cinch before you get on your horse. How do I know that? Because I didn't check my cinch and I ended up on the ground in the, yeah, nice rocky area. You don't wrap a lead rope around your hand. Why? Because Benny Young will come up and yank it and you'll get rope burns on it, and I never did it again. But these lessons that I learned, you know, the basics, if you go through a fence and it's open, you leave it open. If it's closed, you leave it closed. You leave things better than how you found them. Those ethics were installed early on. You know, my parents had installed in me a faith. I had the faith of Lutheran that I was born into. I had a God. There was no doubt in my mind who my Lord and Savior was. I had that foundation, and then I had the practical foundation that these guys were teaching me. And you know, unbeknownst to me, I, looking back on it, it's like, check the boxes on both of them. And hanging out with these guys and getting all this horse information that I was just soaking up like a sponge. I was also watching them. They both spoke Palmel non-filter or Camel non-filter. They both drank Coors Light. There was usually a cooler in the back of their trucks that had Coors Light in them. There was usually a bottle underneath the front seat, and it was usually early times. And I wanted what those guys had. I wanted to be just like those guys. I wanted to ride like them. I'd watch Benny Young. He was a broke down cowboy. You know, he had one leg was bowed out, and he had a messed up back, so he would hobble over, and he'd get up on anything with four legs, and he could ride it. And he could make a horse do things that I didn't think were possible. And I wanted I wanted to be like them. So I started stealing their cigarettes. I started stealing their beer. I think they thought the beer was cute. And cigarettes weren't too expensive at that point, but they I'm sure that they knew what I was doing. But I liked it. What happened when even warm beer, what happened when I drank and I got that alcohol in me? I could ride anything. I knew how to do anything. I was brave. I could go out and there was a horse out there in the same pasture as my mare was, and he was mean. He'd charge you. His name was Sir, and he was, can't believe I remember his name, but he'd charge you, and he would give you a run for the money, unless you stood up to him. You know, I'm 10, 11 years old, and he's coming charging at me, and I stood my ground. You know, Benny always told me, don't show fear, don't show fear, and I was like, I've become. I'm like, yes. Yeah, it's. But I had that foundation of common sense and the faith. And as I got older, and in high school, I learned how to take that common sense and put it in my back pocket. I knew that schooling was very important. And I had teachers that supported me and understood that I learned differently. There was three teachers in high school that understood that I'm a smart kid. I mean, I'm smart. I got the intelligence. I'm just wired differently as far as learning. So they were behind me, but I still didn't have, I didn't have friends. I didn't want them. The whole backstabbing, little schoolgirl bitchy stuff, I didn't have time for it. I had a horse, I had FFA, I had pigs, I had these animals. I got to go to Cow Palace, and, at Cow Palace, I learned how to drink even more, because all the girls were running around going, oh, hee-hee-hee, and I'm like going, we got animals to clean up, get ready for show. And so I there again, I went to the older guys. The seniors took me under their arm and taught me how to drink black velvet. And slow gin fizzes. But that's how I fit in. I could fit in. I could be a part of. I could dance. I never went to a school dance without having, a bottle in my boot. I learned how to smoke weed. There was a gal that showed up that had a horse that she came from Hawaii, and they had a Volkswagen van, and the curtains inside of it had pink flamingos on it. And I can still smell it and taste it of that first time that I smoked weed. Oh my God. I'm like a freshman in high school, and I'm getting high. Now I know that totally affects your brains and your ability to learn and all that. But it was like, okay, I'm a part of, I'm being a part of, I'm hanging out with these people. Would I ever want to go back and do high school again? Oh, hell no. No. I was socially inept unless I was intoxicated. If I didn't have something in my system, I was socially inept. I spent so many lunch periods at Waller Park. I'd ride my motorcycle, my little Suzuki 90, over to Waller Park. I'd stop at the store, and I would get a thing of apple juice, and I'd sit there by myself on lunch. If nobody was drinking or getting stoned over there on the corner, the hill, then I would sit there by myself, and that would be my lunch, and then I'd go back to school. But if somebody was on the hill getting high, if there was some other, oh no, I never went back then. I put the classes that I wanted in high school, the first through fourth. I did the meats processing, I did the OH, and I did ag science. Those were the first four classes of the day, because I wanted those. The rest, mm-mm. I get out of high school. I got to graduate a semester early, basically because I kind of ticked off the assistant principal, and he tried to kick me out, and I had all the credits I needed. So I got to graduate. We had the all-night party for Rigetti High School, graduating year of 77, at the Veterans Memorial Building. Now, that was the all-night party. We had been there earlier in the day, and there was bottles lining the garbage cans in the women's bathroom, because it was supposed to be a clean and sober, it wasn't clean, they didn't say clean, but sober, party for high school graduation. That year, four of the recent graduates, four gals who were driving to, either going to Guadalupe or coming back, I'm not sure, drunk, rolled their vehicle, and all four of them died. And they were graduating students of mine. And they graduated that night, and they're dead. Did that stop me? No. I thought all the cool people hung out at Elmer's, so I started, going into Elmer's. I'm 18 years old, and I'm going into Elmer's, and nobody asked. And the owner asked me, what I was doing the next day, and I was like, nothing. She goes, can you cover a shift bartending? Mm-hmm. Sure, why not? Mm-hmm. I'd probably be there anyway, so what the heck? So I started bartending when I was 20, and on my 21st birthday, I was working the afternoon shift, and we were celebrating, and the owner of the bar, Martha, came in, and she was like, oh, it's your birthday? What are you, 22, 23? No, I'm 21 now. That didn't go over too well, but I didn't get fired. You know, I kept working. I had found the perfect solution to my problem. I could be around people, and I could be able to medicate myself the way I needed to medicate so that I could be with humans. You know, I had this dream of becoming a veterinarian. I mean, that was my dream. I wanted to be, if anybody has ever read there's a whole series, James Herriot, All Creatures Great and Small, Things Wise and Wonderful, about a country vet. That's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be out there in the mud and the grub and working with large animals out at the farm. That was my dream. And instead, I found that being a bartender in a local dive was very convenient and it was very comfortable. And that's what I continued to do. I bartended until I was asked not to anymore. I waitressed, because when you're waitressing, you can drink. That's no problem. You just make sure that it's, if you're waitressing at a Denny's, you can get stoned. When I waitressed at Howard Johnson's, we worked the midnight shift. Oh my God, yeah, our 2 o'clock rush was all the employees coming in with all the good stuff. But I made sure that whatever job I was working, that I was able to stay at the level of intoxication that I wanted and needed. I needed. My brother, by this time, he had gotten married. Wonderful gal in Idaho. He was doing the whole, white picket fence. Literally, he had a white picket fence. Beautiful house. Mom and Dad would always go to Idaho because, that's Matt. That was a stable. I'm not going to say, yeah, I'm working at this bar tonight. Let's do that. I had no want or need of family. The only time that they were convenient was when it was, that phone call, Mom, my phone got cut off. Or they're going to turn off my electricity. Can you help? I lost my rent money. Oh, that was a good one. I don't know what happened, Mom. I had cash, all my tips. I lost my rent money. Okay. I wanted what they had. It was like I was always looking through the window at how they would have a glass of wine, and they would have a candle at the dinner table. My brothers had two boys, and they were playing around, and in this perfect little life. And I looked at that, and I looked in the mirror. I just looked. I couldn't stare. And I didn't like it. I hated it. I hated myself. I absolutely hated myself. I did geographicals. I decided the problem was Orchid, and working at Howard Johnson's wasn't fun anymore. So my roommate and the cook, we decided to go back. She was sick, and she wanted to go back to New Hampshire, where she was from. So I'd say, yeah, New Hampshire was a good geographical. I was there 5.5 months before the state police said that it was probably a good idea and that they missed me in California and I should go. They didn't like the way that I partied, and they didn't like the way the group that I was running with started running harder. So I packed up and I came back to California. I was there. I was there. (clears throat) I went to Fresno because there was a perfect job for me there. It wasn't bartending and it wasn't waitressing. I was working with the Arabian Horse Circle, and an Arabian Horse Ranch needed a person to go and manage their stable. And so I packed up and took my cat and moved to Clovis. And the rules that she had was no drinking on the property. Absolutely no drinking of any kind. She knew I smoked cigarettes. I could sit in my car and smoke cigarettes, but I could not smoke in the barn. I could not. That was the only place that I could smoke, like my cigarettes, and absolutely no drinking on the property. She was, adamant about that. Within 2 weeks, I'd found the dope dealer. I found the local bar. I found my peeps. And I was having parties out at this ranch. They had a pond. And after hours, what are you going to do in Clovis? Well, you go skinny dipping and go swimming in the pond. She came to the stables early one morning. And there was a few people passed out here and there. And there's beer cans every place. I was asked to leave. So me and my cat packed up, and then I was very hurt. My feelings were hurt on that. I had all these good ideas and this practical knowledge, but all I did with it was go, yeah, I know, but this is the way that I think I deserve to live. I got into cocaine over there. Oh yeah, drugs are a big part of my story. I got into cocaine. I thought I had a bad problem, which I did, but I couldn't be an addict because I kicked it with Jack Daniels and weed. I mean, switching from one to another to another. You know, that's why when I read the big book and I was like, okay, well, I switched. Came back to Santa Maria and started the whole thing over again. Started bartending at Moretti's. And then the last place I bartended was Napomo Saloon. And it is literally nicknamed the toilet. I have bartended at McClintock's, at the Swiss, at Shaw's. Pepper Garcia's. You know, nice places. And I end up at a place that's nicknamed the toilet, and for a very good reason. I had picked up on I had also been introduced to that wonderful accelerant, the meth stuff, and I thought that I was in heaven because I could drink more. I had moved from Orchid into Santa Maria. In fact, I had an apartment right over here, about two blocks away. And one of the reasons why I picked that apartment, one of the main reasons was because it was walking distance to two bars. I had picked up three DUIs. On the last DUI, I had been court ordered to the rooms, and there was no way in hell. I'm not an alcoholic, don't you know? We signed our own court cards on that one at Elmer's. There was a whole group of us that had the court cards, DUIs, multiple DUIs. So when I decided that I had to get out of Orchid, and I was looking for an apartment, I was like, this is perfect. This is absolutely perfect. You know, it would fit me. It would walking distance, so I wouldn't have to worry about, the driving thing. And these are two bars that I knew people in, but I didn't know people in, not like, the 18th hole and the office and Elmer's. And I was like, holy cow. And what happened in that apartment is I ended up having my disease, it hit the accelerator, absolutely hit the accelerator. And I am grateful for methamphetamine because it took my alcoholism and it slammed that accelerator right to the floor. I ended up with a very organized garage and very shiny things, and I had a very wonderful, wonderful business going on. And I was doing well. Financially, I was doing extremely well. Because who would have thought that this redneck chick would be dealing dope? I mean, it just didn't make sense. I did not fit the stereotype. I did not. It was like I was being overlooked left and right. It was, you know, people are all, I just didn't fit it. And I had the client, my business was people who didn't fit the type either. I just had this good little niche. And I was financially doing good. I wish I would have paid taxes on that income, but it's okay. Until it got to the point where it wasn't doing anything. I was smoking, I never put anything in my vape. I would smoke the heck out of it, I would drink, and I would go to sleep. It stopped working. The booze stopped working, everything stopped working. And I was living in this apartment. It was very shiny, pretty, and clean, believe it or not. And I was so empty. My parents had gone on a 50th wedding anniversary with the rest of the family, and I couldn't, because I didn't know how to go. I couldn't leave it. I could not figure out how to be a part of that world. You know, I was still looking through those glass windows at the family that I wish I could be a part of, but I can't. I could not do it. I did not fit. And what happened was a wonderful gal, and I have thanked her, turned me in so that she could go free. And Santa Maria Police Department, Sheriff's Department, they all came to my place. They looked through my stuff. And, you know, I knew who it was because when the gun was pointed at my head and he said, "Where's the half ounce?" it was like, oh yeah, I just bought it from her last night, so. My world, I became suicidal. I had no idea how I was going to live because now what? If I don't have the stuff that everybody wants, then nobody's going to want to be around me. I did not know what to do. I was absolutely terrified. I do believe that I tried to kill myself. The 3/4 of the quantity that was left that they didn't find because they only thought I had that much. After my parents bailed me out, how shocking is that? I mean, my parents are socialites, and here on KSBY and KCOY News, here's my mugshot, full name. Yeah, I was mortified. I was so humiliated that my parents were being humiliated by my actions. There was no other news going on. Michael Jackson's trial was over, so it was all about me. I was horrified, and I think that was the first time that I actually cared about anything about my parents. I went through the trial thing, the back and forth to court 100 times. My parents were in court with me every single time. They didn't know what was wrong with their daughter. Their daughter was broken. They didn't know how to fix me. They had no clue, no clue whatsoever. Came down to where I got 6 months and 3 years probation. Okay, I had to do 21 days, and then I got out on electronic monitoring. You would think that I would be able to do that. I was going to be on color code testing, high risk, whatever. What happened is I made it 21 days in jail, and that was the first 21 days I think I'd ever drawn a sober breath without anything in my system. I'd say probably 15 days into it, I still had stuff in my fat cells. You know, I was detoxing hard. I got out, my parents picked me up. They brought me back to my sweet little apartment over here that some friends had taken care of. I paid them with dope and all my animals. And as my parents were pulling out of the driveway after dropping their kid off, with the Christmas stuff, because they were going to Idaho to be with the family, I was taking the top off the handle of Jack Daniels, and I had the pipe that was already loaded and melted, ready to go, and the lighter all wrapped up in that cotton washcloth. And I'm watching them pull out, and I'm doing what I had to do. I can remember that feeling of complete horror of, why am I doing this? What's wrong with me? I'm watching them drive away. My dad had just had a five-way bypass while we were doing the court thing, you know, and he's frail. But I didn't know how to stop. I did not know how to stop. I drank. My poor neighbor, I love Teresa. New Year's Eve day, I hand her money over the fence, and because I'm on electronic monitoring, I can't go anyplace. Like, can you give me some champagne? She goes, yeah, sure, how much? Oh, well, Thrifty's has it on sale. You know, whatever this will get. Okay, having a party? No, it's mine. It's mine. Drinking champagne alone. I mean, puking my guts up. It was like, yep, drink more now. When they finally stopped me, it was January 29th. They had, I had thrown a dirty test earlier. I was continuing to drink and use, and I was cleaning up by drinking bleach and milk and baking soda and getting by on those clean tests. And it didn't happen this one time. And they came and got me, and they right downstairs in the back end of the thrift store, because I had gotten this little job of working minimum wage, hanging racks. They took me into custody, and it was while I was in custody, and my dad came and they were like, "What's wrong? We're done." My mom was like, "We're done," and calling animal control to pick up all your animals and thrift store. Get your crap out, we're done. And my dad put his hand on the plexiglass and he asked me, "Are you done yet?" And I said, "I can't do this. I can't do this. I need help, Dad." And he said, "You need to pray. You need to pray. And God will help you." And I was so miserable. Oh my gosh. I had had oral surgery because all the broken teeth that a meth head has, they had taken them all out. They had dug out all the roots of all these broken off teeth, and so I looked like a chipmunk. I was drooling because I looked like a chipmunk. I was coming off of, and at this time I had started mixing heroin with the meth. So I was coming off of the nicotine, can't smoke, heroin, meth, and alcohol, in jail. Dry socket both sides. And I am so grateful for that. I am so grateful for that pain and discomfort. God knew what he was doing. The first night that I was in Santa Barbara County Jail, the women of Alcoholics Anonymous came in. They brought a meeting. And they looked good. And they smelled good. There's a smell in jail that if you've never been there, you have no clue. It's a toxic body odors combined. But these gals look good, and I didn't understand what they were saying, and I really could not concentrate. My head was just really all over the place. But what I heard was the final reading, and that was, "Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We know only a little." I was like, "What? What? What do you mean suggestive? Maybe I can do that. You suggest, I might be able to, yeah. Don't sit there, you gotta do this, and you can't do that. You tell me I can't do something, I'm gonna freaking do it." But it was suggestive, and they were kind, and they left. And then the next morning, I met Chuck. And Chuck was the director of the STP program, the Sheriff's Treatment Program. Chuck McClain. He was another one of my, "I want what you have." He came in, he was a big Irish guy. Sweet, soft-spoken, full beard. He sits down, he smelled good too. And he sits down, and he the first my first words that I heard out of his mouth were, "Ladies, good morning." It's like, what? 2 o'clock in the afternoon. This guy's on something. And he said, "I get to start my day over at any time. So it's good morning. I always say good morning." I was like, I like that. Okay. And he said, "Look around the room." He said, one of you will make it to a year. He goes, "Figure out which one it's going to be." And I looked around the room. It's like, really? You're telling me that? I'm going to show you guys. It's me. I grabbed a hold of this program with both hands. That night, I was like, "Mom, call Pastor and find out if AA is a cult. Is it okay?" And she said, "Okay, I'll call back tomorrow." And so I did. And she said, "Pastor said it's going to be the best thing for you." Okay. I was given a hardbound book, and I was given a petal from a purple rose one of the gals had in her hair. I did everything that Chuck suggested. When he suggested, when I was whining about, "I'm going to go to prison," because that's where I thought I was going to go. That's why I was told I was going to go. There was no choice. He said, "Do gratitude lists." I said, "What?" He says, I think you should probably do a gratitude list." I was like, "Okay. Really?" And I found things to be grateful for in jail. I found that safest place to this day, when I'm having a hard night with my horrid nightmares and stuff from the dogs, I can still picture that cot, that bunk, the top bunk, and the three yellow little windows. That was my safe spot. I could get up on that top bunk, and I would read my big book, and I would read my big book, and I would write my parents letters, and I would write them letters about what I was reading in the big book. That was the best 93 days of my life. Up until that day, that was the best 93 days of my life. I got out, and I did what was suggested. I left, my parents picked me up. Yeah, 46 years old. Mommy and Daddy picked me up. Yay! They picked me up from Santa Barbara County Jail. Haven't seen my critters the whole time. They kept my apartment. They kept the critters. Dad said, "One more chance." I was like, okay. I hadn't seen all... I had a menagerie. First place we stopped coming back into Santa Maria, I wasn't home. It was a 1600 club. Because Chuck said, I think you might want to find out where your future friends are going to be. It's like, okay. So I stopped at the 1600 club. And I met some people, and I got a schedule. And it was like, okay, this is where, okay. And they said, "There's going to be a meeting at 5:30. I said, okay. That was my new word, okay. My parents took me home. They had gotten some groceries in the house. The cats were all over me. And the bicycle that I did not think that stupid tires on it wouldn't hold air. Oh, yeah, I had taken out the transmission and driveline, my Jeep Cherokee. That was actually a dope deal going bad. But so I had a bicycle, and the tires never stayed inflated. Never. I go to check the tires, because I'm going to ride it back to the meeting. The tires are good. They're inflated. They never inflated again. They never lost air. It was a god shot. It was absolutely a god shot. So I rode my little bicycle back over to the 1600 club. I was shaking like a leaf and scared to death. I didn't know who was going to be there. I figured it was going to be a bunch of strangers. But Chuck told me it was going to be okay. Chuck told me to believe that he believed that I was going to be okay. And I was like, okay. And he told me, he says, I think you should get a temporary sponsor. It was your first meeting, get a temporary sponsor. And I walked into that room, and I looked, and there was a gal sitting at the end of the table. She pulled the chair out, and she said, "What fucking took you so long?" "I don't know." And I went, and I sat my happy camper little tail end next to her. And I'm like, "How you doing?" She goes, "Doing good. You be my temporary sponsor?" And she said the magic words. She said, let me check with my sponsor. It's like, yeah, okay, this is how this stuff goes. You know, I can't make a decision on my own. Since then, my life has changed. I've gone through jobs. I did hanging racks downstairs to drive in the thrift store truck I found out something that on my last DUI, I hadn't paid the fines. I do not recommend this. Highly do not recommend this. I didn't pay the fines. I wasn't going to pay him any money. Well, it had been past that time. So it had been like 12 years. So I didn't owe him anything. When I get my license, I didn't owe anybody anything. I'm like, okay, cool. Yay. Got my license, driving the donation truck for him, working my tail end off. I mean, working hard. Ended up managing the place. I've driven a bus, a school bus. I've worked for the Humane Society. I've had some really cool, interesting jobs. But the biggest job that I had was mending my family. When I got laid off, let go, whatever, from downstairs at the thrift store, my dad's health was deteriorating very quickly. He had had a five-way bypass, he had a defibrillated pacemaker, he had a lot of health issues. And what my job started to be was, when Mom went out and played bridge, Dad and I got to hang out. Dad and I would fix the sprinklers. Dad made it very plain and clear that he wanted to make sure that I knew how to take care of the stuff so Mom wouldn't have to worry when he was gone. He prepared me. He trained me how to do that. He showed me so many things. And it was so awesome hanging out with him. I had that blessing, that absolute blessing. You know, here's this man who made a cage for my guinea pig, for his little girl, and couldn't fix what was broken in his daughter. And then his daughter comes back to him. And he always said, I love this story about the prodigal son. And when he got really bad, and he was in hospice, Mom had had a stroke about 2 months before this all happened. He had had 8 years. I had 8 years of sobriety. On my sobriety birthday, he had gone in to have an aneurysm fixed on my birthday, and we weren't sure if he was going to make it out. And then Mom had the stroke. And I think what happened is Dad got scared that he was going to be left without her. And he was just so stressed out, and his health deteriorated. And here you have this family where I made that phone call to my brother. I think you better come. I think you better come. And he's a normie. You know, he's got grown kids. Last one graduated from college, from Boise State, doing great. And he comes, and my other nephew comes, because he has a business, and he was going to Chile to do some photography on volcanoes. And so he made it, and Mom was in the house. And my God shows off. He just cracks me up sometimes. You got a house full of normies. And who is the one who's charting and dosing out the liquid morphine? Mm. That's the dope thing. After, I look at it now and it's like, whoa, are you kidding me? That would have been, holy cow. But it wasn't, that didn't, God is so awesome. He is so awesome. And that afternoon when Dad passed, I said I wasn't going to do it. I gave him his dose. It was, Ativan mixture thing. Under his tongue, he was comatose. And I gave him a kiss on his forehead, and I told him I was sorry that it tasted so bad. And he took a deep breath, and one tear came out of his eye. And that was it. That was it. And I got to be there for it. I couldn't be there for the 50th wedding anniversary. I couldn't be for all the Christmases. You know, I'm the one who showed up at two drunk cowboys on Christmas Eve with all the fancy silver out, you know, and they're you know, I got to be there for it. In sobriety, it's been amazing. I got to finally get out of that apartment that I was in for over 20 years. 10 years in the disease. Oh man, 10 years in the disease. I collected a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff. And once I got clean and sober, it was a trigger to clean. So, because I used to drink and get high and clean and scrub brush. So moving was going to be a pretty traumatic thing. But I got it. I had no problem. I can do it. I got it. And I didn't. I had a couple of pit bulls try to kill me. And I had neck surgery. I had fusion done. So it was 6 weeks after I had had the neck fusion. And these two pit bulls try to kill me. By the grace of God, they didn't. And thanks to the couple of heroes. So here I am trying to move, and I'm still like, I mean, I am so out of it. I am so out of it. I've got stitches of pulled and teared and torn and just, I was a mess. And I'm going, okay, now what? Now what? These two here, holy crap. This woman climbed into cupboards and pulled out baby food jars because I was going to save all the baby food jars. I was going to make things with them. And something was, yeah. Was one of those busy little things because baby food jars are going to be good for something. Oh my goodness, we can do something. And I had this dump trailer that we kept throwing stuff out of. It was a two-story apartment. Bedroom window. Do you want this? No. Throw it out the window. Throw it out the window. It was fun throwing this stuff out the window. She comes in, Miss Lynn comes in, and she's like, okay, let's get this stuff done. We're going to get this stuff done. Sit down! I guess I was looking kind of pale from here to there, and things were starting to tunnel out. I mean, I was really hurt. And she's, sit down, breathe. You know, every so often I'd be like doing something, and the next thing I know, I'm sitting someplace and she's going, are you okay? Look at me, talk to me. I was like gonna swoon out. But the people that came to my rescue, it was like amazing. It was absolutely amazing. I got to, for my 10 years, I daddy always said, and I know I'm running late, I'll shut up after this. My dad always promised me, he said, yeah, you ever get 10 years, he goes, I'll throw you a kegger. And that was our joke. Throw you a kegger, root beer. Yep, we'll do a kegger. Root beer floats. Dad wasn't here physically, but he was here spiritually, because there was a heck of a good party. You know, open hot dog bar and root beer floats. It was a kegger party. And there was little kegs, and it was like so cool and off the hook of being able to celebrate with all my friends. You know, this stuff doesn't happen to a person who doesn't want to be around people. You know, this doesn't. I don't get it. I don't get it why I'm the one who gets to stay so far. I don't. I really don't. And I'm so grateful that I got this crazy group of gals that I run around with, and that's fun. It's fun. I got the friends that I wanted in grade school and high school that I never got. I got them now. Who would have thunk? No, who would have thunk? But anyways, thank you so much for coming tonight. Have a great rest of your evening.
You shook me up at the end. I can't. Thanks. Okay. What am I doing? I'll just have another round of applause for this.